You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Boisson. Thanks for spending your holiday with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll hear about a unique slice of nature in southwestern Wisconsin, one that you might not expect to find in the Badger State. But first, some sounds of the holiday. Fireworks are an annual tradition on July 4th, and while they may be fun for kids and adults alike, they are actually quite unnerving for pets. In fact, the days around the Independence Day holiday are some of the busiest days of the year for humane societies and animal control organizations, as they field and safeguard animals who have run away. Joining us now to talk more about this is Karen Sparapani. She's the executive director of the Milwaukee Area Domestic Animal Control Commission. Karen, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what is it about fireworks that are so scary for pets?
All right, a lot of people think a dog might be used to thunderstorms. And when thunderstorms come in, there's a change in barometric pressure. There's winds. Dogs can anticipate them. The thing with fireworks is they're sudden. They're not something they're used to hearing all the time. And often there's that smell. So with their hearing so much more acute than our own, the fireworks that can't even be bothersome to human ears are many, many more times louder and more affecting to a dog than to a person.
And what about cats?
Cats suffer the same way. I mean, most people in a room, if you drop a pen, a cat might jump just out of fear. They're very sensitive to things that change. So they're just as bad for cats as they are for dogs.
So how busy is the 4th of July holiday often for your organization?
The 4th of July is like our Christmas or St. Patrick's Day. Every year, without fail, people bring their animals to fireworks displays or maybe leave them in a yard. The sounds that start going off, the dogs and cats panic and flee. And we wind up seeing, you know, in a regular night, maybe 7 to 10 animals on a busy night. Over 4th of July, we get maybe 30 to 50, and that includes the animals that people find in the public that don't actually bring them straight into our facility. It's an incredibly busy night for us. And a lot of animals run away. They get hit by cars. We do a lot of picking up at vets. It's a very, stressful time for all of us in animal control.
So what advice and guidance would you give to pet owners to keep their pets safe, not just with the 4th of July, but especially in a time where there's that potential for getting spooked and running off?
Right. Well, the first thing is always to not take your animal to one of these things. I know, animals are family to us, and we want to bring them everywhere, but they're just not going to enjoy it the way that we will. So that's number one. Don't bring them to a firework display, and do not leave them outside, especially if you're not going to be home or you're out enjoying them, because a lot of times they will just go right over a fence out of fear. A dog that normally wouldn't jump a fence will be right over that thing. So that's number one. But before anybody does anything, as soon as they're done listening to this, make sure your dog or cat has a tag with your contact information on it, because that's the number one thing. Most of them will go to a person once they've calmed down and kind of regroup themselves, looking to get home. And if your animal's wearing a tag with current information, whoever finds the animal could bring it right to your home instead of having to call us and have us pick them up.
And is microchipping also a good option?
Yeah, microchipping's great. You know, everyone should have one of those as their backup. But again, it's not something that if just a person found them on the street, they'd be able to read. They'd still have to take it into a vet's office or a facility like NADAC to have it read. The other thing is, so if you're going to keep your animal indoors, you're going to want to shut your windows. And tonight, it's starting to get sticky, so I think it's okay for us to put on our air conditioning. Leave the air conditioning on. White noise is good. The TV on is good. Make something distracting so they don't focus on the noises from outside. A lot of times we'll recommend, giving them a new toy or a new treat tonight when the fireworks start to, again, just get their mind off of what's going on.
Now, dogs and cats often react to things differently. With cats, it seems to me like their instinct is often to hide. Is it good to give them like a safe space where they know they can go to and feel protected?
Yeah, and it's really easy with a cat. You can get any old box or even a cooler and pop the door open, just a place, put some bedding or some towels or blankets in there, give them a safe space to hide. Usually they want to hide under things. They feel safer under things. Most of us will have cats that hide under couches and things. So they like to hide in a place that's dark and they feel safe. So it's easier to provide that for cats. They're not, like you said, normally going to take off running, but in a house they can feel totally stressed. You also want to make sure they have plenty of water. When they start to pant and be stressed, when their metabolism starts to get up, it's really important to keep them well hydrated.
Now, what if we are the person that actually finds a runaway pet? What's the best thing to do? Is it to take them home with us or get them somewhere that hopefully the owner can be reunited with them?
Right. Well, again, if the animal's wearing a tag, by all means, try to contact the owner right away. We, even though we're animal control, our belief is every animal that we find, we'd rather bring straight home than bring into our facility. So overnight, if people find animals and they are able to hang on to them and call an owner first, they should definitely do that. But if not, in Milwaukee County, the MADAC facility is the place where you would bring an animal. But if you live in one of the outlying counties, it's really important for you to know where a stray animal would be ahead of time. Whether it's your own animal that might be lost or tomorrow morning when you're getting ready for work and you need to drop that animal off because you've not been able to locate an owner, that you find that facility tonight. Almost everybody has a web page. You can look it up in your area and find out wherever you live who you should bring that animal to.
Now, you did just mention that, you know, the weather can get really hot and humid and sticky in the summer. And what kind of things do we have to keep in mind to keep our pets safe so they don't get affected by the heat?
Yeah, the heat is, you know, and we have a lot of problems this time of year. Remember how many times we tell people not to leave animals in a car in the daytime in the heat. Even with all the windows rolled down, people still do it, and animals are still dying. I guarantee you, we've already picked up animals from Summerfest this year from people that have driven up from Illinois, people that didn't want to leave their animal home alone all day thinking this is a better option. It is not. Anytime the weather gets over 70 degrees, your animal faces peril sitting in a hot car, even with the windows fully rolled down. So again, it's important. Again, people want their animals with them, but if they are not going to be able to be indoors or you're not going to be able to keep them with you the whole time, leave them home. They need to not be in cars. They need to have access to cool water, not just a little bowl, especially if you leave them outside. They need a big bucket of water that's cool. We actually recommend for people to get baby pools and fill them up with water and leave it in the shade because your animal will always have drinking water. So they can always go in there, too, if they need to cool off.
And that actually addresses something I was going to mention, that way it can't get knocked over either.
Exactly. We have a lot of people that, you know, will leave a bowl out, but a dog steps on it or knocks it over, then and you could have just left 1 minute ago, mm-hmm. and now that animal doesn't have water for the whole day. So it's really important to, you know, try to be clever. You can get a really cheap baby pool at a Walgreens even has them sometimes, and just fill it up, leave it in your yard in a shady area. This way it can't get knocked over. They're always going to have plenty, and if they're super hot, they can sit in there to cool off.
And Karen, just in the last minute, we have, if someone does see a pet that's been left in a car, what should they do?
Right. We just had a law passed last year. This will be our first summer to do it, to be able to use it. And there's steps. So a lot of people hear, oh, now it's legal to break into a car to save an animal or a child. And yes, it is, but there's steps you have to follow for the law, for you to be protected civilly or from any penalty from doing this. Number one, you have to make sure that you've checked that all the doors are not able to be open, that they're all locked. Number two, you have to look for the parent or the owner of the child or the dog that might be in the car. You have to make a reasonable effort. That might be running into a store, yelling in a park, trying to find the owner. Then if the animal still, you've determined the animal's or child is suffering, they're in stress, they must come out, call 911. Once you call 911, reported the situation, they send someone on the way, then you can break the glass. If you do not follow all those steps, you could be held liable. But again, this is going to save lives, this law, and I'm really, you know, we're really happy that it passed, but we want to make sure people know it's not just you walk up and break glass, that there is a process that has to be followed.
Well, Karen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, you're very welcome. Happy 4th.
To you, too. Karen Sparapani is the executive director of the Milwaukee Area Domestic Animal Control Commission. She joined us to talk about why the 4th of July can be a scary time for pets and what to do to keep them safe. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we learn the stories of LGBT people that are part of larger pieces of U.S. history and the efforts to write them back into the narrative. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
We all hope to be remembered for our successes rather than our mistakes. Watertown's Fred Merkel played on 6 World Series teams but was remembered not for his admirable career, but for one early mistake. Dean Robbins tells us Merkel's story.
I loved baseball as a kid, but I lived in fear of making a mistake on the field. chalk it up to the legend of Fred Merkel, the Wisconsin native who committed the most infamous base running error in the game's history. Born in Watertown, Merkel joined the New York Giants in 1907 as a teenage infielder. His career looked promising until a crazy game against the Chicago Cubs on September 23, 1908. I read about it in horror as a fourth-grade baseball history buff. The Giants and Cubs were tied for first place in the final game of the season, playing each other for the pennant. The score was even in the bottom of the ninth, with Merkel on first base and another runner on third. The next batter singled, the runner on third scored, and the Giants appeared to win the game. Fans spilled onto the field. Merkel dashed for the dugout without getting all the way to second base, his fatal mistake. A Cubs player noticed he hadn't tagged the base and managed to get hold of a ball in the midst of the chaos. He touched second, meaning that Merkel was technically out and the game still tied. With thousands of fans screaming on the field, there would be no more baseball that day. Tragically for Merkel, the Cubs won the makeup game and thus the pennant. Merkel's mistake earned him the nickname Bonehead, and it followed him for the rest of his life. Despite an admirable baseball career, in which he played on six World Series teams, he remained notorious for that one lapse in judgment. The word Merkel became baseball slang for a profoundly stupid play. When he died in 1956, the Associated Press headline inevitably referenced the error. That might have been the end of the story, but believe it or not, Watertown came to Fred Merkel's rescue. Watertown residents looked at the whole of Merkel's life, not just the one error. They discovered a modest, decent man who stood up to adversity. Rather than quitting in shame, he stuck with baseball and distinguished himself as a champion. Rather than lashing out at those who called him Bonehead, he bore the insults with dignity. In 2005, Watertown erected a monument to Merkel, a black stone marker bearing Fred's determined face. It references his outstanding talent and intelligence. Watertown also named a field after him in Washington Park. I hope the kids playing baseball on Fred Merkel Field can take a lesson from its namesake. I know I have. He showed that you don't have to live in fear of making mistakes. You don't have to let others define you. You just have to do the best you can with life's ups and downs. The people of Watertown deserve credit for their wisdom. They remember Fred Merkel not for making an error, but for transcending it.
Dean Robbins is a writer, editor, and the author of the children's book, Two Friends. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now we head to a location that might feel alien to some state residents. It's a desert. And believe it or not, it's right here in Wisconsin. Hosts Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickard spoke to our next guest about the Spring Green Reserve.
Here in the state, we've got lakes and rivers and forests. Believe it or not, there's one place in Wisconsin which is kind of like a desert.
Yep, no kidding. The Spring Green Preserve, sometimes known as the Wisconsin Desert, boasts numerous desert-like animals and plants, including prickly pear cactus, if you can believe it.
Here to tell us more about this unique Wisconsin area is Hannah Spall. She's Director of Conservation Land Management in Wisconsin for the Nature Conservancy, which manages the Spring Green Preserve. Hannah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Very much. Glad to be here. Thank you.
So we've all lived through a Wisconsin winter or two, so it can be kind of hard to wrap our minds around the concept of a desert-like part of the state. How did this place come to be? What makes it different from the rest of the state?
Well, the preserve and the area around it, it's part of the original floodplain of the Wisconsin River, and there's just a lot of sand in the area, and so the bluffs and the flat areas at the base of the bluff are very sandy soils, and so when it rains, that soil just infiltrates very, very quickly into the ground, leaving a very dry xeric site, and it is host then to a suite of species that tend to do very well in dry, sandy conditions.
And to be clear, this is not an actual desert, but it's pretty darn desert-like, it sounds like.
It is. I mean, it rains the same amount there as it would rain in other parts in southern Wisconsin. The difference is that the soil just doesn't hold that moisture at all. And the preserve has a lot of south-facing aspects to it, so the bluffs face towards the south. And so it's a combination of the moisture infiltrating into the ground really quickly, but also an incredible amount of sun exposure. And so things just dry out very, very fast there.
And, of course, this doesn't have the heat that would feature in your, you know, movie screen type deserts, the Saharas of the world and things like that. But as I understand it, at least one kind of cactus is successful there. We usually don't see that around the state.
There is. There's a prickly pear cactus, and you do not need to be an experienced botanist to find it. It is everywhere, and it's all over the preserve. It's from the minute you get out of the parking lot and start hiking, you'll really notice it. It's not a tall cactus. It's something that stays fairly low to the ground, but it's very, very well established and really thrives on the site. And I would argue that if you were out on the preserve in the middle of the day this time of year, it would definitely feel like a desert. The sun really beats down, and it gets very, very hot out there.
What about other critters and plants that are desert-like and unusual to Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just a tremendous number of insects on the preserve. This time of year is a really wonderful time to go and visit a lot of butterflies that are out on the preserve. There's also some species of tiger beetles and some leaf hoppers. So although one might not get super excited at first glance at some of those insects, they are species that are really uncommon and favoring some of those drier habitats. So they're really nice to have there. A really fun thing, you don't usually see them there, but you see the evidence of them. The place has a lot of pocket gophers, and so you see a lot of the burrows and the disturbance of those animals.
What's a pocket gopher?
It's a gopher native to Wisconsin, and it lives underground, but it eats a lot of the prairie vegetation, insects, and, you know, whatever it can find to eat. But it's you see these tunnels, raised mounds and tunnels that are riddled all throughout the preserve. They tend to be active at night, so they're hard to find during the day. And then there's a wonderful set of species of birds that are found on the preserve. You can find meadow larks, grasshopper sparrows, lark sparrows, dick thistles, and just a really lovely variety of species that both migrate through earlier in the spring, but then also a lot of nesting birds that are found in the prairie.
And Hannah, when I think desert, I think of the reptiles, the spiders, the scorpions of the world. Do we see any of those at the Spring Green Preserve?
Certainly some lovely spiders can be found there. Wolf spiders are found there. And there are some reptiles on the property, and they tend to be fairly secretive and a little bit harder to see, but they are definitely there, yeah.
Talking to Hannah Spall with the Nature Conservancy about the Spring Green Preserve, a bit of desert-like terrain here in Wisconsin. Hannah, I understand that as the site gets more popular, that brings some dangers to the site. So if people go and they want to visit, can you give us the rules of Wisconsin's desert so we get to keep it for a while?
Sure. And it really is a lovely place to go, and it's very accessible, so we really do encourage people to get out there and experience the place. The things I would most advise people of, there is a very nicely maintained trail that you can access from the parking lot, and it's about a mile and a half out and back trail that leads up from, it'll go through the prairie, it'll follow along the base of the bluff, and then it wraps around and goes up a hill to the top of the bluff, and you can look out over a really broad landscape of the lower Wisconsin River. Some things to advise people of, we do ask that people stay on the trail. The trail has been placed in a way that is not going to negatively impact vegetation, so we ask that people stay on that trail. A lot of the vegetation there is sensitive to foot traffic, so if a lot of people are walking off the trail and stepping on those delicate cacti and other plants, that will have an impact over time. So we encourage and ask people to stay on the trail, and then we also request that, people leave the plants and animals undisturbed. So no collecting and no disturbing of plants or wildlife that's observed. But just enjoy what you can see from the trail. Take a camera with you, but as they say, leave only footprints.
Are there any particular challenges to managing this pretty unique area of land here in Wisconsin?
There are. It's, you know, challenges and opportunities. The site is what we refer to as fire-dependent, and by that we mean that a lot of the species thrive and do well when they are in a system that is subject to fire. So this area of Wisconsin used to have wildfires go through it on a regular basis, somewhere between annually to every 3 years. And the species that are there really evolved and adapted to that fire going through. The fires moved through most of southern Wisconsin in that fashion. So today, as land managers, one of our biggest opportunities and challenges is to make sure that we continue to apply that fire. And today we do that in the form of prescribed fires under very specific weather conditions, and everybody is trained and experienced in the use of prescribed fire. But we want to make sure that we're able to continue to get that tool out on the landscape. And there are just some logistical challenges in making that happen. And we do a lot of burning around the state in southern Wisconsin in general. So this is one of the places that we really prioritize being able to get that management out there.
And Hannah, before we let you go, I wanted to ask, is there a best time of year to visit and see what's going on at Spring Green Preserve?
Well, I think the name says it for me, and that I would say is in the springtime. The wildflower blooming in sort of May and April is really lovely, and certainly the cactus bloom in mid-June, so that is a really, really lovely time to be out there as well. But as you might guess, there's something out there for everybody during all seasons.
Hannah, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about it.
Thank you for having me.
That was Hannah Spall, Director of Conservation Land Management in Wisconsin for the Nature Conservancy. She joined us to talk about the Spring Green Reserve, which features a little patch of desert right here in Wisconsin. Coming up, we take a look at efforts to write LGBT Americans back into U.S. history. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You know it ain't easy. You got to hold on.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Thanks for spending your holiday with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Reveal. The student loan program was supposed to help open the door to higher education, but it's become something else, a profit center for Wall Street and the government. Reveal explores how this happened and who's winning and losing as a result. That's Reveal, tonight at 7 on the Ideas Network. First, at the end of last month, not long after the massacre at a gay nightclub in Orlando, President Obama gave a special designation to the site of an early and pivotal protest for gay rights.
So this week, I'm designating the Stonewall National Monument as the newest addition to America's national park system. Stonewall will be our first national monument to tell the story of the struggle for LGBT rights. I believe our national park should reflect the full story of our country, the richness and diversity and uniquely American spirit that has always defined us, that we are stronger together, that out of many, we are one.
While the designation of the Stonewall Monument brings attention to a critical moment in the gay rights movement, LGBT Americans have been part of American history from the beginning, and both individuals and groups are trying to restore those chapters to our nation's story. Lisa Ledneiser joins us now. Her Washington Post article about those hidden stories that are coming to light is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Lisa, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we just heard President Obama discussing the designation of the Stonewall Inn as a national monument. For those who aren't familiar with Stonewall and its significance, can you share that with us?
Sure. It was really a pivotal moment in gay rights history back in 1969 when a group of patrons at the bar essentially got into a huge confrontation with police who were harassing them, as was the custom at that time. And gay people in that bar said, you know, we're just not going to take this anymore. And so there was a huge melee, and it really blossomed from there into what later became the pivotal moment of gay pride and the idea that gay people said, we have rights too. We're not going to take harassment anymore. And we're going to stand up for ourselves and assert that we have civil rights just like every other American. We're as American as anyone else. And so that, again, was considered just a pivotal moment in the gay rights movement.
So why is it important to have official governmental designation for sites like Stonewall? What comes with that kind of notice?
Well, it shows this historically underrepresented group of people, whatever the group is, whether it's African Americans, Asian Americans, that they're important and their contributions to society, to American society, are recognized. And that is an enormous, enormous benefit to, say, a family with, in this case, with a child, or a kid who might be struggling with his or her sexuality, to see that there are people out there who have the same feelings and who made contributions to American society, who were like them, lived a long time ago. And it just connects them to the thread of American history in a way that just is not easy to do, but is made much more real with this monument, with the recognition that gay people have been contributing to American society for years, and they've been part of the thread of our national narrative, and they will continue to be part of the thread of our national narrative.
Does this kind of designation also come with, say, funding for preservation or park rangers to tell the story?
Yes, in fact, the National Park Service, at least with Stonewall, is going to be designing some kind of interpretive center and interpretive material so that people know what they're looking at when they go there. And yeah, it is under the care of the Park Service, and it just has a higher, I guess you'd say it has a higher profile than it would even as, say, a state landmark or a city landmark.
In the wake of the massacre at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando in June, the story of the upstairs lounge in New Orleans has been getting more attention because of the parallels in those stories. Can you tell us about the upstairs lounge?
Yes, that was a very tragic, tragic event. And in fact, before the Pulse was considered the worst massacre of LGBT people in American history, it was an arson in this New Orleans lounge back in 1973 that killed 32 people. It remains an unsolved crime. And at the time, the reaction was really disgraceful. I mean, police and officials just didn't really do very, very much to comfort the community. In fact, they denigrated LGBT people. The firefighters are very heroic. They really tried to put out the fires, but they really tried to put out the fire. But politicians and other officials just did not see this as the calamity that it was and did not give it its proper attention. And so for years, it really faded into obscurity. And just in the last couple of years, there's been a documentary and a book written about it. And there's a feeling that this should really be a National Historic Landmark. There is a plaque there right now, but there is a feeling that it should get wider recognition for just the terrible thing that happened there so long ago.
Some people may wonder why bars and nightclubs figure so heavily in gay history. How would you explain that?
Well, gay bars and nightclubs for years were, and community centers really were the only places that LGBT people could gather, because for years LGBT people were demonized and they were made to feel ashamed and that they should be hidden from society. And so often the only places they could gather were bars, were nightclubs, places on the seedier edges of town, places that are actually now being redeveloped. And so developers who come in and try and rehabilitate these places often don't know the significance of the buildings and the significance of what they're looking at. And as far as preservation efforts go, there have been efforts in, say, Los Angeles and in New York, and some have been successful, some have not. There have been some buildings that have been either awaiting National Register of Historic Places listings or have been the subject of great pressure by LGBT advocates only to be turned down and to be redeveloped, demolished. And so that bit of history, it will be lost. And that again, is just a shame, because those places for a long time were very, very important to the LGBT community way before the legalization of same-sex marriage and the recognition that LGBT people have rights, and they those rights should be recognized and honored.
For a local angle to LGBT history, we're joined now by Dick Wagner. He's a former Dane County, Wisconsin board chair and a community historian. Dick, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
A well-known New York City statue that highlights LGBT history was actually part of Madison's landscape for a while in the 1980s. First, can you describe that statue for us, which is called Gay Liberation?
Yeah, it was done by George Siegel, a very famous sculptor. He was commissioned to do it, and there were two castings made. One was to be in New York City near Stonewall. The other was to go to San Francisco. Neither place welcomed them when the offer was made. The one on the West Coast ended up in Stanford. And since the one for New York was mainly in Siegel's Chicken Coop studio, Tom Garver of the Madison Art Center brought it to Madison to display it at the Art Center and engaged me and some other folks in conversations about, well, couldn't we keep it in Madison and put it on display outdoors, as it was intended to be outdoors, not inside an art center? And we said, sure, we can do that.
And so where was it placed in Madison outdoors for people to see?
It was placed in Orton Park on Madison's Near East Side. It was originally the Village Cemetery and then became the first park in the city. And it happened to be in my particular supervisory district, so I was able to help convince any skeptical neighbors, and there weren't many, that it would be an ideal location. And we got very early project funding from New Harvest Foundation. And we felt that since Wisconsin in 82 became the first gay rights state in the nation, to have a statue with gay liberation in its public parks would be just great.
And tell us what the statue looks like.
The statue consisted of two men who were standing next to each other, and two women who were seating on a bench. There were two benches. And, you know, the most serious sort of affection was some light touching. And if you didn't know it was called Gay Liberation, you might not particularly find it offensive, but it became a big battle royal with a big park commission meeting to actually locate it there in the park. But the park commission decided, yes, it was appropriate, and it was.
And how long did it stay in Madison's Orton Park?
Less than a decade. New York finally got its act together and decided, yeah, they really did want it. And so many here were sad to see it go, but we knew it was here only temporarily. And we miss it still. There were postcards made. During winter, people used to put hats and scarves on the statues, sort of blending them into our Wisconsin atmosphere. So it was affectionately received. The students at Marquette Elementary did a school project about it. And it was a good thing to have it here.
And what is the significance of where the statue is now in New York City?
Well, that's a national site. And Wisconsin has its own gay and lesbian landmarks that ought to be recognized, and its own history that ought to be known. Too much, we think, you know, gay rights are just a coastal thing. But in fact, Illinois was the first state to decriminalize homosexuality. Wisconsin was the first state to make non-discrimination against sexual orientation a legal basis. And so we think we recognize what happens in New York and San Francisco and other places, but we have our own story to tell.
Well, Dick, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing that chapter of Wisconsin's history.
Sure.
Dick Wagner is a former Dane County, Wisconsin Board of Supervisors chair and a community historian for the LGBT community. Turning back to Lisa, while there are efforts to recognize locations and stories that are specific to the LGBT community, like that Dick Wagner just shared with us, there's also a push to add the LGBT angle back into known histories. And one that you discuss in your article that made me think we should talk about this on the 4th of July is Independence Hall in Philadelphia. What's the history that's been lost there?
Well, at Independence Hall, back in the 1960s, on July 4th, there were a group of demonstrators, very primly dressed at the time, who marched past the Liberty Bell every, again, Independence Day, reminding the public that gay people lacked basic rights. And those came to be known as Reminder Days, again, the reminder that gay people did not have the same basic rights as straight people. And that lasted from about the mid-1960s to the end of the 1960s, and of course, after the Stonewall incident, then everything shifted toward New York, and the focus shifted there into other cities that started having gay pride parades and gay pride recognition events. And so Reminder Days really had been lost to history for years until a National Park Service ranger named Michael Doveton said, you know, we really need to incorporate this into the stories we tell at Independence Hall, stories that connect the Liberty Bell to, say, the suffrage movement, to the civil rights movement. And so on his own, he started talking about those protests, and that led to an exhibit last year that included some of the replicas of the original signs that the marchers carried, a discussion about the difficulties gay people faced during the 1950s and 1960s, such as a threat of unemployment under an order signed by President Eisenhower that basically had the government terminate anyone it considered a, quote, sexual pervert, unquote. And so now when people go to the visitor center at Independence Hall, there's much more of a discussion about, again, Reminder Days and about gay pride and LGBT rights, connecting that to the other independence movements that have been connected to the Liberty Bell and to our history of independence as a nation.
We're talking about efforts to write LGBT Americans back into our nation's history and some of the fascinating stories that have come to light as a result. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you aware of LGBT people or stories that are not part of the standard history? If you're part of the LGBT community, who are some of the heroes that you wish were better known? And do you agree with President Obama that the strength of our nation comes from making sure that everyone's history is shared and preserved? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll be back with this conversation in just a moment here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're glad to have you with us for this 4th of July holiday. We're continuing our conversation now about writing LGBT people and their stories back into U.S. history. Lisa Ledneiser is a multi-platform editor and Sunday magazine writer at The Washington Post. Her recent article about LGBT history is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Lisa, right before we went to break, you mentioned the one park ranger at Independence Hall who reminded people or reinserted the story of the Reminder Days into the story of Independence Hall. Who else has been quietly adding LGBT history back into the narrative?
Well, for instance, museum staff members at Beauport, which is a historic landmark in Gloucester, Massachusetts, tell tourists that Henry Sleeper, who was the house's owner and one of the country's first professional interior designers, was gay. And that decision to mention that came in 2007 when employees who sort of knew that he was gay found evidence of his sexual orientation. That same year, the Jane Addams Hull House Museum in Chicago moved a painting of Addams's companion, Mary Rosette Smith, to Addams's bedroom with a label describing the significance of the relationship. Addams, of course, founded a well-known settlement house and shared the 1931 Nobel Peace Prize. The museum also now gives gender and sexuality tours about the history of gender nonconformity in Chicago, linking that to LGBT rights. There are also efforts at Valkill, the Hyde Park Cottage built by Eleanor Roosevelt and two other women, to highlight Eleanor's ties to women and their partners who shared her progressive ideas. And also in Richmond, California, there are efforts by a local historian to include LGBT stories at the Rosie the Riverfront World War II Homefront National Historical Park. It's a little bit of a mouthful. But that park is one of the newest ones in the National Park Service. It opened in 2000. And again, they are going to be mentioning in an exhibit later this year Bev Hickok, who is a lesbian Rosie who assembled airplanes, and Jeffrey Dykman, who was known as Mildred while he was a member of the Woman's Land Army. He lived as a man later in life. And so efforts like that, again, are just a couple that are going on around the country to include LGBT people in stories of folks that are very well known but are not complete.
This is an interesting cultural development on its own, the resurgence of these stories and putting them back in their place in history. But you've also noted that at this point in our nation's time, it also seems especially interesting when other aspects of history that are considered less appealing are actually being downplayed or minimized. What examples do you see of that?
Well, the removal of Confederate flags and statues, the questioning of the place that they have in our national narrative, the National Cathedral here in Washington, D.C., deciding to remove two images of Confederate flags from stained glass windows. Those are just a couple of the efforts, again, around the country to think, do we really want those symbols as part of our national history, and how do we deal with those in a way that those questions were not asked 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. And so I did find it very interesting that at the same time that LGBT history was figuratively coming out of the closet, Confederate history and parts of our national narrative that are not so nice to remember are going back into the closet.
And what is the danger that you see in putting those stories into the closet, or, you know, putting them under covers, brushing them under a rug?
Well, I don't know that there's a danger. I think there's an effort to really think about the story we want to tell about ourselves as Americans, and about the stories that we choose to highlight, the stories that we choose to maybe give less importance. And I think there's just a very interesting historical discussion going on. What parts of history deserve prominence? What parts of history are incomplete and not told as thoroughly as they should be told? And I think that's a very healthy and robust discussion that should be happening everywhere, not just at national park sites, in history books, in the stories that we teach our children in schools. Are they really getting as a complete history of the United States as they should? A couple of months ago, I did a story on Japanese-American internment camps during World War II and the fight over whether artifacts made at those camps belong in a museum or at the camps themselves. And again, I was struck by the fact that it is known that Japanese Americans were interned during World War II, but it's not widely discussed. And I think, again, the more we have discussions like that everywhere in the United States, at park sites, in schools, I think the more complete understanding we have of who we are and the mistakes we've made in the past and why we made those mistakes and how we shouldn't make those mistakes again.
In researching your article, Lisa, was there a particular story that we haven't mentioned that really affected you?
Wow. There were a lot of stories that I found really interesting. I think the one I found very intriguing was the story about Harlem's Apollo Theater. I mean, we all know that it was very famous, especially during the Harlem Renaissance, and a lot of incredible performers came through there and really changed the musical scene. But I didn't know that the nation's first racially integrated drag production was performed there, and that there were several performers who were fairly open about their sexuality. Comedian Jackie Moms Mabley was known to be a lesbian, and she joked openly about the old man she was married to, a union that supposedly was forced upon her at an early age. I had no idea that the Apollo had that kind of history behind it, and so that was fascinating. And that's why I think this effort to tell a more complete history of places listed on the National Register, and also to get places on the National Register that aren't listed, is just going to give us a wonderfully complete and much, much richer history of these places that just isn't there now.
Well, Lisa, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
You're welcome, and thank you so much again for having me.
Lisa Ledneiser wrote an article about the hidden stories of LGBT Americans that are coming to light. It's linked on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.